netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Hi, I'm Jim Montgomery. Thanks for joining us for this week's FX Podcast. Our subject this week is going to be Letters from Iwo Jima. That's a Clint Eastwood-directed film with effects work done by Digital Domain. But before we get to that, I want to take a moment to talk about an upcoming podcast, and that's going to be with the systems team from Autodesk in Montreal. Now, for those of you who don't follow our site, what happened in December was about 10% of the staff was fired, or I guess as they like to say in corporate terms, laid off or downsized. But there's still a great number of people up there working on Flame, Fire, and Luster. And we're going to have an opportunity for you to ask questions of this newly reorganized team via a podcast. So what you need to do is send us an email at podcast at fxguide.com. That's singular, podcast at fxguide.com. You can also use the Contact Us link on our homepage to send your question, and we'll pass those questions on and use them actually as part of our podcast. Now, this isn't some thinly veiled or not so thinly veiled program to for me to avoid having to actually come up with questions for the podcast. I'm still going to do so. We've talked a lot in the past about how we could maybe involve our audience a little bit more at FX Guide. We feel that this might be one way of giving our listeners kind of better access to the people that we're interviewing on the site. So again, feel free to drop us questions for that. Again, podcast at fxguide.com or use the Contact Us link on the homepage. Now on to this week's subject, Letters from Iwo Jima. What's interesting about this film is they weren't planning on initially doing two films in the series, not two companion films along with Flags of Our Fathers. But what happened is Clint Eastwood became quite interested in the story of General Kiribayashi, who is the commander of the Japanese forces on the island. He actually had some people do some research into that as well as some preparatory screenwriting for it. And as they were heading, or right before they were heading to Iceland to film scenes for Flags of Our Fathers, he actually got the first draft of the script and realized it really was a good idea to go ahead with the film. Now, when looking at making these two films, Eastwood considered shooting in a digital format, but decided film was the way to go. But what he did do was make his first foray into a DI process. And he did this because he wanted to have a very contrasty and desaturated look, at least among other reasons. And what he was able to do is take it and push the look further in the DI process than he could using a chemical lab process. They actually did the grading on a DaVinci 2K Plus with footage that had been conformed in Autodesk Fire at 2K. And the reason I mention this is because it did have implications while they were doing their work at Digital Domain. They had to make sure that their composites, when they were compositing normally, would actually look good when the stratistic look was applied to them. So let's go ahead and pick up the interviews now. Mike Seymour is going to speak in a little bit with Jeff Kim, who was involved with Roto on the film, and there was a ton of Roto, as you'll hear. But first, he's going to speak with 2D supervisor Darren Poe, who's with Digital Domain. So let's go ahead and join that interview now.
Thanks for that, John. And Darren, thank you for joining us from Digital Domain to talk about the films.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So it's an unusual thing. We have two films, not sequels, or one isn't a sequel of the other, but in fact companion films. It must have been unusual to work on two films with this kind of background.
Yeah, it was actually a pretty unique project for us. The idea to create the second film sort of came in the middle of the live-action production of Flags of Our Fathers, and became just something that just grew out of what we were currently working on, and we just rolled from one project right into the next with the same group of people and the same tools and, just building on the things that we had done for Flags.
I once actually heard someone at ILM discussing the fact that by the time they'd finally worked out how to make a film and gotten up to speed and finally got everyone doing the right things and worked out the looks, the film finished, and it was always a shame. So I guess to some extent, when you got to do Letters, you actually had the pipeline nailed, and it must have been a lot easier tackling the shots and adding to them effectively.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we had the whole vocabulary down at that point, and we spent well over a year building pipelines and doing development, from the early stages on Flags through being able to finish shots, and then the production of Letters, which was another close to 300 shots.
Now, the actual release of the films was going to be in February, and then it was brought forward for limited release in December, with the main film going into full release around January 19. But your dates didn't change, did they? It wasn't like you were suddenly shortening. I mean, it was a short post time, but it remained constant for you.
That's correct.
In the second film, Letters from Iwo Jima, in fact, the filmmakers ended up filming on the real islands because this was something not possible in the first film, because by the time we got to the islands in the narrative of the first films, they'd been bombed pretty much to a point of being unrecognisable. But, of course, in the second film, Letters from Iwo Jima, the Japanese are setting up there and working there before it's been bombed by the Americans. And this allowed the filmmakers, as I understand it, to go and actually film on the real islands in the second film. Is that correct?
That is correct. They had about a five-day shoot on the actual island itself.
And you were saying that was actually both obviously very culturally sensitive and also at some actual risk, because there's a lot of unexploded ordnance there, as well as, of course, being the unmarked graves of many soldiers that died.
Right. The island is a protected sort of historical site, as well as sort of being viewed as a memorial for, you know, the people that died there from both sides, and it's been sort of untouched for that reason. And there's a lot of unexploded ordnance and things of that nature still strewn all over that island.
So yeah,
it's very dangerous for them to, for people to go there really at all.
I understand that from the production that they in fact had to get permission from the governor of Tokyo, because the islands are actually a part of the city of Tokyo, which is extraordinary if you think about it, being 700 miles away. But let's swing now to talking about the visual effects and the works. So you were a compositing supervisor on the films.
That's right.
And if we just talk, I guess, work our way into the work that you were doing, most of the stuff actually revolved around stuff on the islands, wasn't it, in terms of visual effects?
That's correct. We did a lot of work of extending the island or adding Suribachi, which is sort of the main featured mountain in the background. We did some extensions of encampments and things like that, and quite a lot of battle scenes and just, you know, small invisible type effects here and there.
So most of the compositing was done on Nuke, I presume?
Yeah, that's correct.
So let's work our way through the shots from, I guess, starting from the plate photography and stuff. There wasn't much green screen used on set, was there?
No, there was pretty much no green screen or blue screen work on Letters from Iwo Jima, and very, very little on Flags of Our Fathers as well.
So
everything was just shot, you know, as it existed, and we had a really big crew of roto artists who worked really hard and roto a lot of items.
And that can't have been that easy, because some of those sequences are, you know, I mean, obviously there's some sequences that are quite almost melancholy or foreboding before the attack, but once it gets into the battle and stuff, I mean, that's pretty much hard-paced stuff to roto.
Yeah, exactly, and you know, there's lots of soldiers running around between branches and trees and through the grass, and there's, you know, just all kinds of stuff that had to be done.
And then you would have had to have also done a fair amount of 3D tracking, especially to extend stuff up. What 3D tracking program were you using? Were you using the in-house stuff there?
Yeah, we have our proprietary tracking software called Track that we use to pretty much track every shot, whether, you know. That's pretty much the first step that happens. You know, whether we think it needs it or not, we just track it, and then we have the 3D camera data, which, even if there's nothing 3D going into the shot, in the composite, even for roto, it was really useful to have 3D camera information to, you know, actually place roto on cards in their, you know, correct 3D space in the scene.
Talk me through that a bit more so I understand it. So how are you using the camera data with the roto?
We're able to bring the camera in and then determine where objects are in the scene based on the information from the track, and then you can put a card with a mat on the card in 3D space, and then just let the camera move, create the motion of the non-internal animation of that object.
Right, I understand that. And then you'd just be doing the articulated movement around effectively the edge of what's going on. And
But it's basically taking an axis of, you know, movement kind of out of the equation of having to be done by hand.
And that was Doug Noble, is that right, who wrote Track?
Yeah.
And I think he went on to get a technical Oscar for that, because it's...
He did.
Outstanding stuff. And then, now the 3D department, I was really interested when I read that on some of those massive naval shots, you were actually using some behavioral stuff to animate some of the ships so that it wasn't all just done through keyframe animation. Could you talk about what the 3D department did there?
Yeah, absolutely. We use the massive software to generate animation for, you know, the waves of landing craft, LVTs and Higgins boats that were coming ashore. And then within each of those landing crafts, so like an open-backed Higgins boat would have 20 soldiers in it, which they all had their own internal, you know, massive animation sim as well.
So it's sort of like there was both sim work done for the boats and sim work done for soldiers in the boats. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, exactly.
And how did you find Massive to work with?
Well, I mean, as the compositing supervisor, I wasn't really that close to the actual nuts and bolts of using the software, but we were able to turn around some pretty complex and pretty interesting animations pretty quickly with the software. And it was just cool to watch all of the, you know, the progression from the motion capture that was done for all the individual soldiers, and then have that, you know, plugged into the engine, and then, you know, seeing the sort of the creation of these really active and large armies, that we were able to extend the very minimal sort of onset action with.
The 3D, when rendered, then let's say, you know, let's take something like a plane that's coming in for bombing or something. Walk me through what you would get from 3D. How would they render that? Would it be a complete solution with some simple mats, or would you get it as a multi-pass render?
Generally, for things like airplanes or ships, we had a set of you know, different passes that were baked into the EXR files that we would bring into Nuke, which included, you know, a diffuse and a spec component. Oftentimes, we had all of the different AOV passes, ambient occlusion, stuff like that. Fresnel, and a lot of times we were able to request specific additional passes like wide depth passes or, you know, things like that to further control the element. And all of these channels were baked into the file itself.
And so that one file basically contained multiple versions of the data in different forms, and then you'd composite those together in Nuke, and that actually comes in pretty seamlessly to Nuke, doesn't it? That workflow's pretty tight.
Yeah, I mean, we're able to read in I think up to 64 channels in an EXR file, so we have access to a lot of that data there. And then using, you know, like shuffle tools and things like that, you could take the image as it came out of lighting, which was generally, you know, pretty unbelievable and great to begin with, or you could sort of reverse, you know, deconstruct it back to its you know, component passes, and then tweak them and then reassemble them you know, as needed, which we did a lot for the water effects as well.
And of course, the great advantage is you didn't need to go back to re-render them unless the actual motion was wrong.
Yeah, that's correct. We had a lot of control in the composite, which we tended to not need too much with the hard surface renders, because they looked beautiful out of the box.
And when you were compositing those big shots together, especially the water, what, I mean, if in broad terms, that's a killer question, but what were you doing to sell the shots? I mean, what were the things that, you know, if you were looking over someone's shoulder that came in, you'd say, these are the sorts of things I've been finding that have really made a difference to selling the shot? Mm-hmm. Was it like additional smoke elements? Was it controlling the spec highlights? Was there anything that...
Yeah. Well, I mean, we did such a wide range of, you know, different types of shots. And generally we had, since we were, you know, in a way we were fortunate because we weren't using blue screen plates, we had a bit more of a context of what kind of the world around, you know, a group of guys running through, you know, the sand or something should actually look like. And, you know, we had a lot of hooks in there that we could use to sort of match our stuff to, and it, you know, it gave us a lot, we had a lot of guidelines for, you know, what needed to be added. And, you know, we just did a lot of little subtle things, like, you know, we, you know, extending the beaches and having, you know, sand kicked up by the treads of these tanks as they're coming through. And these are all, you know, really small in the shots and, you know, in the distance, but the cumulative effect of all of those little things and, you know, CG footprint dust, you know, on all the different massive soldiers as they're running around and, you know, the footprints they leave behind and stuff like that. So just, you know, a lot of focus on, you know, a lot of little subtle things that you wouldn't necessarily notice on their own, but sort of taken together, I think, really helped the realism.
So when you didn't have green screen and stuff, it would be almost impossible to roto something like Smoke because it's transparent. So was it a matter of just digitally replacing that, or did you use stuff shot against black? Or, I mean, there was a lot of smoke and a lot of dust and second stuff kicked up.
Yeah, that was actually quite a big challenge for the beach shots in particular. Oftentimes we had the practical effects on set, you know, like they did a, you know, like a ground pyro charge, you know, behind some of the main actors. But we were adding, you know, 25 more of those explosions going off in the background and, you know, sandwiching in a lot of CG soldiers and stuff. And so there were a lot of instances that came up where we had smoke or, you know, dust or sand, you know, little particular things sort of blowing around the foreground that we had to get behind and we, you know, to put Suribachi back there or something. And, you know, did a lot of work with keys to do that, and there was a lot of this like hand painstaking roto, and you know, we did do some element shooting, which we were able to, you know, pull keys off of some of the elements that we shot and then use those as the mats for, you know, a different explosion because they tended to be, you know, somewhat similar. So we use and adding smoke obviously over the top of it. So a lot of little tricks like that to try to get behind this stuff. It was quite a challenge.
Now, one of the things I've always loved about Nuke is its 3D compositing capabilities and its use of being able to do large matte paintings and do camera mapping and projection and stuff. And you did a certain amount of that in this film, didn't you?
Yeah, we did. We did a combination of things, either putting matte paintings on cards, obviously, you know, kind of the easier stuff, building a sort of 360-degree world of smoke and water to kind of go around the island as background, and then we would, you know, put in the foreground piece that we had, or in some cases we were actually projecting or reprojecting sort of Terrigen renders. That Terrigen is our in-house terrain software. We take those and do matte paintings on the, you know, rendered output of that software, and then reproject that onto the actual island geometry, which we had in Nuke as a 3D object.
And what sort of resolution would you get out of Terrigen? What sort of resolution as a compositor would you have? Because obviously it was a 2K final output film.
Yeah. Generally, we were working with renders, you know, from the camera perspective. So we were using, you know, oversized, what we call an oversized render, which was just slightly higher resolution, you know, slightly wider pixel aspect than standard 2K.
And when you were putting these stuff in, I mean, one of the things to obviously sell these, apart from things like black levels and stuff like that, is just the grain management and being able to blend the foreground stuff with the background. And they were shot on fairly modern stocks, but any issues with getting the grain in there and getting that kind of, because it's quite a gritty film, or was it pretty easy because it was in the DI later that kind of crunched up?
Well, we actually, I mean, it was interesting on this show. Most shows that you work on have a, you know, pretty substantial DI, the thing that happens to them at the end, so oftentimes you're surprised at, you know, how different the film looks. But in our case, we were working with, you know, just sort of the original full color space. You know, it was pretty nice, evenly toned, and the ultimate look of the film was going to have a very high contrast, very desaturated look, so we had to sort of predict in advance as much best as we could what our shots were going to look like in that context. And to do that, we created some custom viewing LUTs for different display devices that we have, which would approximate that look.
Right, because it really is virtually a monochrome film. I mean, I think it's a beautiful look, but it's there's not much there in terms of color. It's really got.
It was surprisingly unforgiving to desaturate shots. You would think that it would actually make things easier, you know, you get away with a little bit more, you know, imbalances between black levels or color or something, but it really actually had the effect of enhancing and exaggerating those things, so we had to really be very careful to look at our work in our presentation of the final look as much as possible.
And so, that's interesting. So you basically went through and worked on a sort of a rough approximation of what that would look like, and then but then delivered still the full-color versions for later treatment?
That's correct.
And when you were reviewing stuff with either the supervisor or the director, was that the full color version, or did you show them the one through your temporary LUT?
It varied. We did some tests early on with trying to show the work in the sort of like the post DI look world, but because you know the ideas of how it were going to look, you know, were evolving while we were doing, you know, it became sort of problematic to show the work in that way. So we tried to just establish a system of looking and judging the work in a full color format, and then if there was questions about how it would look in the you know what was thought to be the final DI session, then we would actually dial those color corrections in on the fly with the client.
I mean, obviously, in a film like this, there's a lot of credit that has to go to the actors, like Watanabe, who was the lead Japanese soldier, and just, I thought, magnificent performance. Just, God, I hope they respect him come Oscar time. But there's a huge amount of the visual presence of that conflict that is visual effects. I mean, for people that don't know, there was a lot of work done to build those scenes up, wasn't there? Because it was shot in Iceland.
Flags was shot in Iceland, and Letters was predominantly shot in California, so there was even more work to be done in Letters to basically make California look like Iwo Jima as much as possible. And
I didn't know that. So even the more bleak battle stuff that looks identical to the stuff that's in Flags was actually shot on a completely different continent.
Yeah, exactly. And we, like, for example, there's quite a few scenes on the beaches where we, you know, these scenes were shot in California, so they were on these sort of nice, you know, blondish sandy beaches, and we had to get in behind all the foreground stuff and you know, turn the sand into this sort of distinctive black sand color that Iwo Jima has, which is very, very different from what you would see in California. And, you know, just something that simple involved, you know, a lot of keying and roto of you know, people just standing against, you know, their natural background. So we did a lot of work, you know, really hidden work like that to just create that environment.
Wow, I had no idea. I mean, I know that we said before that some of the earlier stuff was shot on the actual Iwo Jima, and I believe some of the cave stuff was also shot there. But the rest of the underground stuff, was that shot in studio then in California, or because there's a lot of stuff that happens underground?
Yeah, exactly. A lot of that was shot in California, yes.
I can't thank you enough for taking time to talk to us.
Well, thank you very much for the kind words.
Well, as Darren mentioned in his interview, there was a considerable amount of roto that was done. And, of course, there was a lot of roto that was done in Flags of Our Fathers as well. There was very, very little green screen. The idea of having a giant green screen on the beach obviously certainly did not suit the purposes of production. And so roto was a critical aspect for that film, and again, for Letters from Iwo Jima. So to that end, the next part of our podcast, Mike Seymour speaks with Jeff Kim, who is the roto lead for Digital Domain on the film.
Thanks for that, John. And Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Sure. Glad to be here.
So obviously a lot of it was written, especially when the first film came out, Flags, about the fact that there wasn't a lot of green screen use, if any, and there was really a lot of roto done. And now with Letters, again, you know, the same issues have come up, and it really was a remarkable effort from your team. Now, we've heard that some of the shots had enormous amount of either man days or people actually working on them. What was the sort of scope of the size of the project in terms of how complex the shots were?
Each shot was different. We'd go in and bid on the shots and see what was needed to roto. Depending on how many soldiers on the plate and what was going behind them, that's how we decided, okay, how many people on this shot and how many man hours it would take and stuff like that. There was one shot where there was about 16 soldiers in the shot, and we had four people on it for about 3 weeks.
Wow.
So, yeah, so each shot was different, you know.
We've heard a little bit, but I'd like to go through it with you if we could, about some of the approaches that you're using. And so if we could just step through, you know, I know every shot's different, but an approximate average shot. As I understand it, the first thing that would happen is it would be tracked in track, right, to get a 3D camera move?
Yes. Well, integration would get all the shots first, and they would attempt to do a track. And what we would do is use that tracking information as much as possible and get the camera move. But when you've got soldiers walking along the ridge line there, most of the integration people or our trackers won't track the actual soldier. What they'll do is just track maybe the far like background, so we could put the armada back there. So in that case, we have to do our own tracking using Nuke and all that, and apply that tracking to our Béziers and work it in that way.
So effectively, each soldier in that shot gets its own track, of course, because you want to basically have that moving the roto splines of the individual shoulder in one unit, correct?
Yes, that's correct, because you could have one soldier walking screen left and another one walking the screen right, and you're going to need two different tracks, obviously.
I was going to say the other critical thing is that for people less experienced with roto, it's not the case that you're trying to do a single roto for a single soldier, is it? I mean, it's a large number of splines that make up the solution for a roto for one soldier.
Oh, yes. One soldier could have taken at, 20 nodes because, you've got a roto like the straps of his helmet, and those appear and disappear as the shot goes on, and then his nose or just, the straps on his shirt, So, yeah, each soldier had his own artist that they worked on. So that's how we broke it up, mainly. Each artist got one soldier.
Now, at this stage, let's assume that there's some motion blur in the shot. As I understand it, for some or all of the shots, you were doing pretty much a solid black and white matte, effectively a roto without much softness, and then running an optical flow analysis on the foreground plate. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. That's what we did. We've got it's called a motion vector blur, where the node actually gets the camera data. You connect your node to that, your Bezier node. You hit run, and it would apply the motion blur accordingly. That tool really helped us a whole lot, especially with soldiers running, because you can barely see what's going on. It's not very opaque in some of the parts. So the vector blur, the motion vector blur, really took care of that really well.
Now, the thing about an optical flow analysis is it's often been described as a chicken and egg problem, because it needs to identify objects to try and isolate. And when, of course, once it has objects, it can do much better motion vectors, which would help define an object.
Right.
So it does occasionally get things wrong. How would you adjust that?
If it didn't work, then we just have to manually soften the Bezier ourselves. I would encourage each of the roto artists to talk to the compositor and see exactly what he or she would need. So we would actually get the compositor's composite and feather out accordingly.
So there'd be an iterative process of them doing a comp in Nuke and then you going back and reworking some of the rotos. Would that be correct?
Yes. There wasn't like a step by step. You wouldn't just roto and hand it off, and then that would be the end of it. It would always come back. With roto, you're always taking two step forwards and one step back. Yeah, usually about the two steps forward, one step back, because you do a version one of your roto, and you think, okay, this is going to work. So you give it to the compositor, and what they'll do is plug it into their script, run it. And then when they say, okay, Jeff, we need some more tweaking or whatnot, we'll actually open the compositor script and see exactly what is needed and apply motion blur or softness to the mat as needed.
So now motion blur is a function of the shutter angle, and they were shooting obviously traditional film on this, so it was a manual shutter. So does that node take into account does it have literally like a 50% shutter, or how does it compensate to produce the right amount of motion blur?
That's the advantage we've got with Nuke here, because all of our software writers are here. So whatever shutters you guys use, whatever shutters that directors or whoever uses, we can adjust our nodes or our program to that shutter.
Great.
So there's, you know what I mean?
Yep.
So it's custom made, actually.
And so once we've got that that iterative process going with the mats, there's still going to be a vast amount of stuff that doesn't neatly fit into the mat category, I guess, like, sorry, the roto category, like, there was a lot of dust, stuff that was kicked up, and in particular, obviously, transparent stuff. So how did the roto department deal with that?
Right. Well, it's, the main thing about roto is you roto the most opaque. You could only roto what you see. In some cases, they'll say, well, just carry the shape on until you can see that shape again. So you kind of just fake it until you can see the shape again. So usually it just depends on the compositor and on the shot, where we had some shots where it's, the compositor says, well, if you can't see the leg any longer, then you can just go ahead and pull your spline off. You know, but then let's say you can see the leg on frame one, but then you don't see it on frames 2, 3, and 4, but it appears again on 5. You just kind of let the Bezier do the interpolation. You set a keyframe on frame 1 and set a keyframe on frame 5, and you let the computer do the interpolation, so it looks like the leg is actually moving in those frames where it's not, where you really can't see it. So, and we'll do like a color correction.
So did you just, I mean, if you hit an actual explosion, was that something that roto just had to pass on, or was it a case that you had roto the solidest part of the explosion and then leave the, I'm just trying to get a feeling for that line where roto stops, if that makes sense.
Luckily we did not have to roto too many explosions or any smoke elements.
Right.
It was just the soldiers, and if they ran into the smoke element, then you would carry your Bezier spline all the way until you could not see the soldier anymore, and then you would just pull the splines right off the shot there.
And so we touched on how you would attach people to shots. What was the size of your total team that tackled the project?
I had a crew of about 20 people.
Right. And
you
ran from one film straight into the next, I presume.
I led the team for flags, and since I've been here for a while, they let me composite for letters. But I did help out the new lead for letters, and she was on my team for flags, so she knew exactly how to go about the shots because they were pretty similar.
What was her name?
Her name is Viviana Kim.
So that team that was the core was presumably considerably larger than Digital Domain maintains. I mean, presumably they were freelancers.
I think it was like the biggest team we had here on any project.
So you are saying that you composited on letters. You must be embracing the fact that because there wasn't the green screen. I mean, it's a double-edged sword, as we've heard before. That, you know,
the green screens. No, actually, those didn't help at all.
So on letters, in fact, the fact that they didn't use green screen actually was a positive thing.
Yeah,
because it was a positive thing in that you had very accurate lighting, you had very good material. I mean, there was obviously the work there for roto, but from the sound of things, you're going to get that sometimes anyway, aren't you? And just in terms of the workflow with Nuke, I'm really interested, if you've got, say, a dozen soldiers, and, of course, each of those is being rotoed, and then each of those, obviously, multiple splines, we're working in an OpenEXR environment. How responsive is Nuke when we're still, you know, at a stage where all of those rotos are live and able to be adjusted?
So what I would do personally as a compositor is, if I see, like, let's say one soldier has like 20 Bezier shapes, but the soldier looks great and I don't need any more work with him with the Beziers, what I'll do is I'll render the alpha as opposed to having all the nodes, because if you render the alpha, it obviously Nuke doesn't have to think about all the shapes and splines and all that stuff. So if soldier one is good, I'll render his mat out and just plug the mat in and not use the splines anymore.
Right.
Then that would lighten up your script a little bit.
I think the films were absolutely brilliant. I mean, I just some of the best work I've seen out of Digital Domain in a while, and definitely some of the best work that was done last year. Full stop. So,
great. I'm really happy to hear that. Thank you.
Great credit also to what is, let's face it, sometimes a bit of an unsung department. The roto department doesn't always get the credit it deserves, perhaps. So.
Well, I thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak for me and on behalf of my crew. I couldn't have done it without my crew, and I give them all the credit in the world, because they're the ones that put in all the hard man hours and just dealing with a lot of stressful times, you know.
Well, you know, if the roto hadn't worked, the film wouldn't have worked. You know, it was that vulnerable.
That's correct. And I think it all happens within the group. You have to have a really good understanding of your people that you're working with, and you've got to treat them well, or else they won't work hard for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially right. when you've got a team that's that large over such a long yeah. period of time. It was months and months that the whole team was together, right?
Yeah, it was a pretty long time, and we sat in one small room, but, you know, we managed. We became a really close-knit family after the show. That's why it's hard to see people go, and we try to keep as many people around as possible, you know?
Well, again, thanks so much for taking time to talk to us.
All right, thank you, Mike.
Well, thanks, Jeff, and thanks, Darren, for taking the time to speak with us. Really enjoyed those interviews, and I really enjoyed the film itself, actually. I'd suggest if anyone's out there to definitely take a look at it. It's one of those things that the pair of those two films together has honestly spurred me to find out a little bit more about the actual battle and research history. And I think that's always great when you watch a film, that you take something away like that interests you and leads to learning more about an event in history. Before we close out, I want to remind everyone again that we're going to have an upcoming podcast with the systems products team at Autodesk. They're the guys who make, and gals who work on, fire and smoke and flame and inferno, as well as luster. And what we're going to do is take questions essentially from our listeners and readers. So if you have a question, send us an email to podcast@fxphd.com, or you can use the contact us link at the top of the homepage. Well, until our next podcast, for my partners Jeff Huser and Mike Seymour, thanks for taking the time to listen. Be sure to visit our site and also check out our training site, fxphd.com. We'll see you online.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2007 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.